Welcome back to another episode of Macam in the Middle. We're back with something slightly different today. Obviously, refereeing in the Championship and on a wider scale in England is a talking point on a weekly basis in modern day football and almost regularly for the wrong reasons. We talk about it a lot in the Reaction podcast we upload after games, and you know, it's always a debate on Twitter, on social media for all clubs in the English pyramids. Today, we are joined by a former referee who demonstrated his trade between 1981 and 1999, refereed in numerous FA Cup finals, amongst other competitions. Keith Hackett is with us today. And first and foremost, before we get into any of this referee debate, Keith, how are you getting on?
I'm getting on well, thanks, Joss, and delighted to join you. I've had some happy times at Roker Park. Yeah. And of course, when I was boss of the PGMOL, visiting the new Stadium of Light, which is a fantastic setting. I always remember that first Roker Roar, which sent hairs on the back of my neck standing up. Sunderland also has a memory for a guy who looked after referees. I think he probably still does, George Baker. Mm. And a terrific guy, makes it very friendly for referees to visit at Stadium of Light, does a terrific job.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned to me earlier as well that I think, is it the club you work for, the chairman's a Sunderland fan?
Yeah, Bob Murray, I knew quite well. He was in the kitchen industry with Ram Holdings, a huge company, and I was a competitor in that I worked as the sales director for Crosby Kitchens then, no longer. And yes, we always had to exchange views about kitchens and various other things when we met. But I suppose the classic was, refereeing Newcastle Sunderland one Sunday morning. And that was a game that probably shouldn't have been played because it was so wet, so muddy. I'd call it off, in fact, earlier when the police came in and insisted with the approval of the Football League that the game went ahead. At the time, both managers were shaking their head as we walked down the tunnel. But it was a great day. Yeah.
I mean, we'll jump straight into it. And obviously from when you were an official, it's fair to say, I think football's changed quite a bit. Especially over the last few years. And obviously, we'll get into a few of the things that have changed, especially obviously VAR. And I think it's also fair to say that refereeing's become a bigger talking point than it ever was before. Again, probably mainly down to the fact that VAR has been introduced. What are your current views on the whole kind of situation on officiating in England at the moment?
Well, let me take you back a little bit, because when I retired from refereeing, eventually I became the boss of the Professional Game Match Officials Limited. Mm. And introduce sports science, fitness coaches, sports nutritionists, sports psychologists,
yeah,
product called Prozone. So I knew exactly where our referees were operating from a quality point of view. We did move into the professional era. And I think that my brief was to create a cadre of world-class referees. I think I achieved that. What I have seen in the last 10 years, and this is not me sort of chuntering, I mean, I've made comments publicly and in writing in the press, I've seen the decline of refereeing standards. If we take one simple thing, the process of a referee is to see, recognize, think, and then act. And that's the decision-making process. And if you can't see, then you can't make the right decision. So the first thing is, are you fit enough and are you getting in the right positions to see the decisions? Because you cannot guess as a referee.
Yeah.
To aid that, the first thing that I did was to say, right, okay, I'll introduce communication kits so that referees and assistant referees didn't have to come together for a chat. They can actually talk to each other throughout the game, if they wish.
Yeah.
I then had the problem, as the boss of the Premier League refs at Manchester United, when Roy Carroll, the goalkeeper, dropped the ball a yard over the line. Mark Clattenburg was the referee. He was stood near the halfway line. He had no chance of determining whether the ball's crossed the line. And the assistant referee was in the right position with the second in line with the second rearmost defender. He couldn't make that judgment either. So that started for me the train of bringing in goal line technology.
Yeah.
And in writing that brief and the criteria of how it was going to operate, I made it clear that, one, we didn't want the human element involved. So it became very much that scenario. Very clear, a single message to the referee that the ball has crossed the line. And we saw this weekend, just gone, two incidents where it was close to crossing the line, but the right outcome was achieved. When we come to VAR, VAR is, again, a system that is relying on the human element. And therefore, what you have to do when you're involving any form of refereeing or any sort of role in a business, if whatever, is to write down a very clear criteria. So if we take what has happened, and I just go back a little bit, in year one of the introduction of VAR, the Premier League said, no, we're not having it.
Yeah.
The MLS took it on board. And then in year two, Mike Riley made this decision that the pitch side monitor would be only used sparingly. And in year two, I can tell you the facts are that the referee went to the monitor three times in 380 games.
Jesus.
Then we had year three, and we get this and since, and we get the automatic, if you're going to the screen, you're going to go with a VAR.
Yeah.
And at the same time, we've got clear confusion, in my opinion, as to what is a clear and obvious error.
Yeah.
And so as a result of that, I think that there are several pointers. First of all, trying to be absolutely perfect and therefore double-checking, triple-checking before they actually award a goal delays everything. Not communicating to the fans in the stadium is a big no-no. In the modern age, we're putting a slide up on a screen and saying we're checking offside.
I think the problem with that is, as well as, you know, I've watched some games, and I mean, obviously we're in the Championship and previous being in League One, so we haven't had to deal with it, but you watch some games on TV and I think there's like a 5-6 minute gap between the goal either going in or a penalty decision not getting given, and the fans are just there with no clue as to what's going on.
It's interfering with the enjoyment and therefore it's delaying that, bite of being able to cheer on a goal. What happens now, a goal scored and everybody's waiting for the outcome. Even the players are waiting for the outcome. So, right, then we come to the other aspect, don't we, of offsides. And again, I take you back when we clearly saw the lines being drawn and going off in all directions with a piece of technical equipment. And you go, this is a no-no. And you also then want to look at the technical equipment that's in use and do a comparison. It might surprise you that to get to a simple goal over the line decision, the first thing is, why haven't we got cameras in goalposts? The reason being is that in no stadium are the goalposts vertical and parallel with each other. So that's why you can't have cameras. So then when we go through, and we did this at Fulham's training ground at Motspur Park, we set up a rig with cameras. The outcome finished up that we were operating seven cameras around each goal, operating at 500 frames per second, and a computer software that reacted very quickly to give a buzz to the referee's wrist, it's a goal. When we look at offsides, And the crazy situation that we've got ourselves into with offsides in the Premier League in particular, we've had almost the nonsense of the technology, i.e. the camera speeds, ensuring that what you could do is pick up the wrong image.
Yeah.
So if you take a slice of bread and you'd slice it 500 times, that's what you get in relation to goal line technology in simple format. If you do it on broadcast speeds that can be anywhere from 63 to 100, you can pick the wrong slice of bread that gives you the wrong decision. Yeah. Whereas if you pick three or four slices in the middle of the 500 frames, you're going to get an accurate decision. So the technology is behind. The criteria of operation is behind. Now we get to people. So how can you have a referee who might referee on a Friday evening, say at Old Trafford, he gets away from that ground at about 11, 11.30. He's then got to drive to Middlesex to be VAR for the 12.30 game.
Yeah.
Oh, and by the way, it's the guy who's the top of the pile, who's absolutely sitting in that top echelon.
Yeah.
And it could be the guy who's new to the league this season. And you've got a guy whispering in your ear, that's a foul, that's a red card or whatever. You see how it is that relationship problem that needs to be overcome. So, look, when I was boss of the PGMOL, I had that problem. I had the problem of different assistant referees week in, week out with the same with the referee. So the referee would arrive at the ground and he was meeting two assistant referees. He might have worked with them that year. He might have worked with them the previous year. So I brought them together in teams. And so the referees like Webb and everybody else had the same assistant referees throughout. It then became a better working relationship. You know, if you're in employment or you're at school or whatever, the people you know, you trust, you build that trust, you build an understanding, you can actually be more open.
Yeah.
You know, if you're a linesman sitting there, you can go into the dressing room and say, hey, mate, you got that one wrong. Or why did you miss me flag? Or all those sort of scenarios. Yeah. But VAR at the moment is too remote. Now, for me, that has been under the stewardship of Mike Riley.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to give you another fact, and that is, I do believe that declining standards has taken place. And I think that is surprising when you consider that this is not a funding issue, because when I left, The turnover of that business was 5 million. We were spending 5 million on referees in that PGMOL.
Yeah.
That figure, and these are recorded figures at Companies House, because it is a business, is now standing around 23 million.
Oh.
So there's a substantial amount of money going in.
Yeah.
And then also what we've got is, there's a lack of transparency and a lack of accountability. Now, I tried to overcome that because when we had assessors, particularly in the Premier League, we also had match delegates. And I persuaded the Premier League to form a list of match delegates, which were former players, former managers, to actually judge and assess the referee's performance, as well as the former referee.
Yeah.
So that's where we sit. And I think it's, I think the only light on the horizon is that Howard Webb, who has for a number of years been the boss of the referees in the MLS, introduced VAR into the MLS. And has operated with a guy called Greg Barkey. You know, it's pretty tremendous. They're getting quite good results. It's never going to be perfect because a lot of the decisions are subjective.
Yeah. But
at the end of the day, it's got to improve, and the standard of referees got to get back to where it was. I mean, you know, in your area, Okay, we've got Michael Oliver, and he's the benchmark for current refereeing standards. Yeah. Him and Taylor set the benchmark, and that's what everyone should be aiming for. When I was boss of the PGMOL, it was people like Mark Clattenburg, Mark Elsey, Graham Paul, Howard Webb, and before my era, it was people like Pat Partridge.
Mm.
And in my era, it was people like George Courtney. These were the guys who set the standard of English officiating here and overseas. And when you look at Oliver is a good referee.
Yeah.
You'll not see much in the Northeast because there's that resistance to get appointed. But he's a guy who's very young, he's mature, performed really well at the World Cup, and consistently is performing well in the Premier League. But if I was his coach, I'd still be wanting more from him. I'd still want him to be absolutely the number one in the world. That's where it should be. In the way that Clattenburg and Webb achieved that status when I was the boss.
Yeah. And obviously, like we say, VAR is something that gets talked about a lot. And obviously, with us being in the Championship, we're going to get on to some of the decisions that have obviously went against us so far this season alone. But do you think it is a matter of time before, the Championship, possibly League One, League Two, get VAR? Because as I've pointed out to a few people now, the promotion from the Championship is probably the biggest aspect of world football, really, financially. I think you get 100 million for promotion, and then obviously the parachute payments that follow. And, if it's quite easy to blame refereeing decisions for reasons why you've dropped points. But ultimately, there will be teams come the end of this season that will look at some decisions that have went against them, that have cost them points, possibly cost them playoffs, or, I think Middlesbrough third at the moment could possibly cost them automatic promotion. So do you think it is a matter of time before you start to see VAR trickle down the pyramid?
I think you're right, first of all, to say how important the Championship is, because they have more supporters than Serie A in Italy. And the game is viewed around the world. And the one thing that I want as a former referee is our referees to be the best in the world.
Yeah.
And I believe that around my era, and I'm not taking the credit, it's the individuals that I work with, achieved that goal of having a cadre somewhere around about 10 referees that were really world class. So I think that given the importance of the Championship, it's got to come in, VAR. But it will only, in my opinion, come in if you get the right personnel and the quality of operation. I mean, if you're sitting there as a board member of the Football League at the moment, and you see what's going off in the Premier League, then I think you've got to say, look, it's not quite ready yet. The personnel are not right. The management's not right. So I think Howard Webb has got a job to get it into a position where, like the Scottish Premier League, they've introduced it this season. They will go through teething problems until you get people properly trained. But I think Webb is in a position, as a good communicator, to ensure that these people are trained adequately. But I think what he's also got to do, he's got to surround himself with some better people, some better refereeing coaches and the like. And I think what's also got to happen is they've got to go for the semi-automated offside system. And that will then bring dedicated cameras, not broadcast cameras, dedicated cameras, artificial intelligence coming into the system, and a more accurate decision and a more accurate outcome. And I think that's where it's got to come in, and it's got to be in that position. But of course, semi-automated has got to be introduced into the Premier League first before they consider the Championship. But looking at some of the decisions on the clips that you sent me, I think that referees cannot be happy that they've come away from a game. And if they're doing the job, I used to spend a lot of time looking at my own performances, looking at areas of where I can improve. And I'll admit very, very clearly, as referees, as human beings, we make mistakes.
Yeah. That's assuming, isn't it?
But we also have to interpret accurately. And we also have to manage an event. And yeah. And so, again, I know we're majoring on Sunderland and probably the Championship rather than the Football League, but one of the problems that you face in the modern game, which is really concerning, is time delaying tactics.
Yeah.
And for the fan, there were three games last year in the Premier League where the actual playing time was 45 minutes.
Yeah.
And currently it's 55 minutes. And that's, if you like, is cheating the fans.
Yeah. That was the next point I was going to get onto is, you know, just the general timekeeping of games. Because I think there's been so many times this season, you know, I could go through and name the teams that have come to the stadium alight, wasted time and got away with it. And there's not been any punishment whatsoever. But I mean, the Coventry game at the weekend, for example, you know, it didn't really affect the game in the grand scheme of things. But the first half, Coventry scored a goal. Obviously, they have the celebrations to go away to the fans, celebrate, get back to the pitch, kick off. I think there was a player went down injured, down for a minute or two. And at the end of the half, there wasn't a single minute of added time. And, you know, I think Redden was a good example of this as well when we played them at home. They came to stadium alight from the first minute, wasted time, no punishment whatsoever. Throughout the game, not one player got yellow card. And like you say there, fans turn up to watch 90 minutes of football. Yeah. Pay to watch 90 minutes of football, which nowadays certainly isn't very cheap. And like you say, it's fair to say they aren't getting that nowadays.
Well, I think for 10 years, I've been beating the drum that we need an independent timekeeper.
Yeah. I think what you saw at the World Cup was kind of what you need really in league football. Because I think there were some games where there was 16, 17 minutes at a time, which is like one of the first times you've ever seen it in football.
I think that's a recognition by FIFA that there is a timing issue. There's a problem in the game. Look, I used to see it when I refereed in Europe. When we had a two-leg game, and you went to appointed to the first leg, what you had was the away team on the first leg, delaying as much as possible. And I think that highlighted for me that as a referee, you have to take action, even if it's in minute one, minute two, speeding up the goalkeeper. But let's look at the areas that, I mean, believe it or not, Law 12, and I'm not going to get too technical here, but I'm often asked, I just confirm that in Law 12, indirect free kick, a goalkeeper who has the ball in possession of his hands has only 6 seconds in which to release it. If not, an indirect free kick is awarded against him. Now, I haven't seen that in years.
Yeah, I think I've seen it once at the stadium, right? And everyone was so confused because, like you say, you don't see it anymore. People don't realise it's actually still a rule.
Yeah, it's still there. Now, you then look at the surrounding of referees. That's a time-wasting tactic. We've now got, haven't we? We know that players know that if they go down holding the leg, they might get shipped off the pitch pretty quickly to be treated off the field of play. What do they do now? They hold their head, knowing that that is going to be a difficult scenario for the referee because he's now got to go through the medical checks. Rightly so. But my problem here is that there's going to be a referee who's going to ignore a particular head injury in the future. And it's serious, you know. I mean, you know, head injuries are something that we must take very seriously. But I don't think players should use it as a form of tactic to delay.
Yeah.
So we're getting unnecessary injury scenarios.
Not to go to the Coventry game every single time here, but again, happened in the Coventry game. I think their keeper, just before half-time, he's down holding his head.
Yeah.
Referee blows for half-time. The keeper's up on his feet as soon as that whistle goes and he walks off the pitch. Yeah. And I think one thing that we mentioned in a reaction podcast that we did recently was some kind of rule to be brought in where if a player does go down with a head injury, let them off the pitch for 5-10 minutes so they can get properly checked, checked to see if they can continue. Right. And then you're probably not going to see people going down when they're not actually injured.
Well, I think concussion substitutes is how I was hoping that it would be introduced. And I think it's common sense, isn't it? But sometimes football doesn't take the common sense route.
Yeah.
And I agree with you that, you know, we had a period, didn't we, a few years ago where injuries on the field of play couldn't be treated on the field of play. There was a cursory inspection and you had to go off.
Yeah.
All that has been watered down. And now we clearly, you know, we're not daft as fans, are we? We know what's happening and we know that we're getting cheated, because what happens tactically is quite simple in football. If you're the team at, towards the top, gunning for promotion, and you're playing a side and you're managing a side that's probably nearer the bottom, right? You're looking at your games throughout the season. You're thinking a loss, a win, a win. And then I don't know. And all these sort of scenarios come into play. And you're suddenly getting teams going, I'll be happy with a draw, yeah?
Yeah.
And as a result, what we're going to do, boys, is if you feel a bit of a twinge, go down and we'll have an injury delay. In the same way that they're making life very, very difficult for referees. And this is particularly in the Championship, where VAR is not coming to play, but we're not seeing it in VAR. And that is, we're still seeing a lot of acts of simulation. Players who are manufacturing contact and going down, looking for a penalty kick.
But just to add on to that as well, which I could be wrong on this, and I'm sure you'll correct me, but is a yellow card offence, but rarely ever gets given as well.
Correct. I mean, in putting myself in the referee's chair, when you're actually cautioning somebody for an act of simulation, you're publicly saying that player has cheated.
Yeah.
The problem as a referee that you've got is, on that first view, you've got to have the ideal viewing angle and you've got to see it clearly before you issue a caution, because you've got to be right in your own head that he has simulated as a means of gaining something to deceive you as a referee. But it's very difficult, because you've got that other aspect of he's actually avoiding getting crocked by an opponent making a challenge. Therefore, he's gone over in order to arrest. But look, I'm not looking for excuses. I think the reality is that week in, week out, we're seeing an increase of acts of simulation that are cheating everybody, their opponent. I'm concerned. I mean, look, I refereed in the Football League in the 70s through to the mid-90s. If you look at games in the 70s and early 80s, they were tough, physically tough. Players took one and gave one. And I'm not saying that we ignored that. We gave the free kicks and all that went with it. But in reality, there was a general respect, a greater respect towards the opponent. There was still that willingness to win. But I think it was just like, I'm not, less cheating, I think, in my era than what we see now.
I think the trouble now is, as well, if you look at especially the top players, or former top players, if you want to, you look at Ronaldo, you look at Neymar, some of the best players that have ever played. And one of the first things that you think of when you see them is simulation, especially Neymar. You know, he'll go down six rows, he'll be back up on his feet. And I think the trouble now is that, especially, you know, young kids growing up aspiring to be footballers, is they'll look at Neymar as a role model. They'll see him win a free kick from no contact. They'll start doing it in Sunday league games. They'll get picked up by an academy. They'll do that. And it's just this kind of constant cycle where players look up to those at the top and just copy what they do and get away with it now.
I mean, you're absolutely right. And you're spot on in understanding that whatever takes place in the professional game cascades down. And of course, when we see dissent, acts of dissent, I mean, recently, Anthony Taylor, one of our top referees, was surrounded by Arsenal players. And I'm not just highlighting it, you know, and not for the first time of Arsenal surrounded. And other clubs are doing the same. And they were recently fined £75,000 for that offence. And, OK, to you and I, that's a lot of money.
It's penny slim.
But in terms of the professional game, it's nothing. So what it does is it sends a message, frankly, that at grassroots level, life is now much more difficult. I mean, I'm president of the Northern Counties East League. I'm very proud to be president. I'm also president of a non-league club, Penistone Church FC. We run about 20-odd teams, boys, girls of all ages. And I see, you know, what is taking place at a weekend cascading down, a lack of respect for referees. Now, we as a club, I've got to tell you, play a big role in trying to get our players to behave properly right the way through. And parents, when they're at grassroots football, as a league, you know, we introduced earlier in the season where we said we do not want managers approaching the referees at half time, because that was suddenly beginning to be an escalation.
Yeah.
And the problem there was you got one manager following the referee towards his, you know, the exit to the ground and stadium, arguing his case, and the other one thinks he's been, if you like, influenced when he starts the second half. So all those aspects we take into account. But, you know, for youngsters now coming in, and that, you know, they're 16-year-olds, some of these kids, boys and girls, and they need a degree of protection and they need a degree of help. You know, when I started refereeing, and I did 12 years at grassroots before I got onto the Football League, but even when I was a Premier League referee, and I can tell you that the people, you know, I know for a fact that George Courtney would referee like I would an international game, and probably at the weekend he's going to referee the school kids or grassroots football. And, you know, we all did that in our era. Yeah. That tends not to be the case now. But the reality is that you want young referees coming through and you want them to enjoy the game.
Yeah.
But they've got to be better.
They do, yeah. And then just before we move on to looking at some of the decisions that have obviously went against us, what more do you think actually needs to be done to not only benefit the clubs and the players, to make sure that obviously the decisions that are going in the game are the right decisions, but to help the officials as well? Because it's something that people, especially football fans, don't really think of, is the fact that referees are human beings as well. And you see it, especially at the top level of football, where there's some referees probably getting death threats and, you know, having the family talked about on social media and saying this, that and the other. And whilst, you know, teams are dropping points that they probably shouldn't be dropping if the right decision was made, something's also got to be done to protect the officials from this criticism in the future.
Yeah, well, what we have seen at grassroots football first is this, the last couple of weeks, we've seen a trial being introduced where the referees are wearing body cams.
Yeah.
I do think that genuinely that every club should have a referee mentor. And by that, I mean someone who can actually introduce themselves to the referee prior to the game and then look after that referee during the course of a junior game.
Yeah.
I think at the top level, what has got to improve is the communication and understanding of what is taking place. Now, I started to do that. I mean, I used to address a lot of fans, clubs, go and visit them and discuss with the fans various aspects of refereeing. Used to go on the media and say, you know, accurately what's gone off.
Yeah.
You know, I even started media training for the referees in the hope that, you know, look, some of the referees that I manage, you take... Jeff Wintu lives down the road from you. Brilliant communicator, wonderful after dinner speaker, brilliant communicator as a referee. And the reality is that skill set was being developed, but then the clubs got involved and said, no, we don't want referees doing post-match interviews. And I've gone, why? I've trained them. And the outcome was, well, you know, referee so-and-so sent a player off. He explained what he was sending him off for. I think it was Rob Stiles. And that's stopped us being able to make an appeal. We can't appeal against that red card. So that sadly was binned. I think we will see, I mean, Mike Riley's been missing for years. We've not heard. Mm. I think already I'm seeing signs of Howard Webb willing to talk willing to inform and educate. And I think that's a good thing. Look, we'll always have a difference of opinion. That's football, because yeah. a lot of the laws, if you like, are subjective. But I think that in those situations, we've got to say why they're subjective. And I think then managers have got to have confidence in that if they do make a call into the Football League, if they're in the Championship, or into Howard Webber's the Premier League. Look, just to clarify that point, the Professional Game Match Officials Limited are responsible for all the referees that operate at professional level. So, in a sense, whilst I think it's Mike Jones of the Football League, there's got to be an understanding that, you know, if I had managers who were unhappy, I would get in the car and go and see them.
Yeah.
Sit across the table, not defending my cause, but listening to what's being said. Yeah. And I think that has to take place. And, you know, I can remember going to Everton with David Moyes when Fellaini had joined, and in 10 games he'd had 10 yellow cards, and there was a concern. And I went across to Farmfield, the academy, and had a screen with 10 of these yellow cards up on the board. And I think I started the conversation by saying, well, if we look at this one, and this one, our referee's got it wrong. It's not a yellow card. But I'm going to stand by the 7. And we ran through each one, and I explained, look, Fellaini is holding. The attacker is away with the ball. He's now being grabbed. That is a foul and a yellow card for stopping a promising attack. It's unsporting behaviour. And I think from that, there was a debate and discussion. And for the next few games, Fellaini didn't get a yellow card. Not because I mentioned that to referees. Referees weren't involved in that conversation at all. It was actually saying, look, you as a manager have got to recognise to some degree how you can interact with your own player to resolve an issue. How many times do we see a player get a yellow card knowing that he's running the risk of getting a second yellow, but he stays on and then gets a second yellow? And you think, why didn't the manager bring him off? Or why didn't somebody have a chat to him? But look, that's me being clever.
Yeah. Well, we'll move on to some of the decisions, which I know you've had a look at. And so far, I think you share similar opinions to many Sunderland fans on these ones. And quite frankly, we'd be here all day if I picked them all out from this season. So I haven't done that, which obviously doesn't really benefit anyone. So what I've done is picked out a few that have massively impacted directly a game. And we're going to discuss some of them now, starting with Blackburn, which I'm sure everyone will remember that game, a 2-0 defeat, an even game from both sides, and a game that I don't think either set of fans could have complained if it did finish a draw. Their opening goal comes from an incident on Jack Clark in their box. It's not given. They go up the other end straight away, and it's a fantastic strike from Diaz, not taking anything away from that. But I've watched it back 1,000 times. Obviously, I think this game is on Sky as well, so they showed replays of it. Everyone's seen it multiple times, and every time I've seen it, I thought it was a penalty. What are your views on this one?
Well, I think if we look at this, what we see is the left foot of the defender makes contact, very clear contact, with the Sunderland player.
Yeah.
It's a foul. And again, you look at the positioning of the referee, he's out of shot initially, and you then say he can't have seen possibly what we have seen. Could the assistant referee have helped in that process, looking across? I doubt it. So it's down to the referee. This is a penalty kick. It's for me, I have to tell you, it's an easy penalty kick.
Yeah.
But just to, again, go into that a little deeper, and that is what I would do when I was boss of the Premier League refs and the Football League refs, was I would ask that referee, talk me through that decision. How did you come to the decision not to award a penalty kick? What did you see that I don't see? If VAR had been in operation, this is one where VAR would have come in.
Yeah.
Because it was a clear and obvious error. And I would have then expected the referee to award a penalty kick. So for it, it's no VAR and you're down one. And you're right. This is where VAR, if it's operated correctly, gives you the view that the referee may not have had. He can't guess on penalty kicks. It's a gut. You know, as a referee, it's a gut feeling. But let me tell you this. What we have seen, what I have seen as a former referee, I've seen referees in very good positions operating at Premier League level, being an ideal view, not giving the penalty kick, waiting for VAR. And what I, you know, I had a conversation some years ago with the famous rugby union referee, Nigel Owens. And Nigel Owens said, the one thing that VAR or TMO brought into rugby was for a period lazy referee. And he admitted he'd become slightly lazy. And I think that's what's happened in the Premier League. An over-reliance or a fear factor, whatever it is, of I don't want to make a mistake. And if you start thinking about these decisions, right or wrong, I don't want to make a mistake, then that's not a confident referee. You go out and you have to generally, without the arrogance, you have to say, everything I give is right. You know that then you review the situation afterwards. But you've got to have the confidence.
And obviously that incident is a foul. And with any foul, really, it's like we've said earlier, it is an opinion-based one. You know, if you ask 10 people whether you think something's a foul, 9 might say yes, 1 might say no. It's very rarely you're going to get 10 people say yes or 10 people say no. But the second goal in the same game is another area of debate. And I say debate, there is no debate about this one because with offside, you're either offside or not. Free kick, which I can't remember how the free kick actually got given in the first place, but I'm pretty sure it was a free kick. The player who scores it is in what I would say is a clear offside position. The concern here is how has the linesman missed this?
Well, let's talk through. First of all, if we look at the law on offside, being in an offside position is not an offence. So you can stand in an offside position. The ball can come across, and because you've not become active, right, interfered with the opponent, then you're not in that situation, you're not offside. So if we get back to this decision, the player is clearly offside, and in my opinion, is in the sight line of the goalkeeper. The path of the ball, you know, if you take a couple of feet either side, or less, it's in the zone of the goalkeeper. And therefore, in my opinion, he has interfered with the opponent, the goalkeeper, on this occasion, and offside should have been given. So let's just understand the process here. If you're the assistant referee, you're looking across, you're going to flag because the player is in offside and the ball has come near him. So you're going to say, it's offside. Then the referee has got to judge whether that player has interfered with his opponent. That's the joint working relationship between a referee in that aspect of the offside law. Again, with VAR, I would have expected VAR to have ruled that out. But in fairness to you and your listeners, I have seen these types of incidents go unpunished and a goal being allowed. So I think that is an area. And, you know, we had the, if you go back, we had the Marcus Rashford incident a few weeks ago where he received the ball. He was well offside. He followed the ball towards the edge of the penalty area. And then the goalkeeper's come out and the goalkeeper has set himself awaiting a Rashford shot when Fernandes came in and scored. And that goal was given. And I was just shaking. In fact, I wanted to throw something at the television because that, for me, is offside. And I was pleased, although it took a bit of time, of an explanation by Howard Webb, that his expectation would be that that would be given as offside. And we got into this whole subject of deliberate play.
Yeah. I think what people say nowadays is there's a guy behind me in the Sunderland games who seems to think you're only offside if you touch the ball. There's so many times where a ball will go over the top to, you know, Ross Stewart or something early in the season where he'll go for the ball, you'll not get it, it'll be given as offside. But people don't realise that you don't actually have to touch the ball to be offside. If you make an attacking move to the ball.
Yeah. You're in effect, if you're deemed to be making a deliberate play,
yeah.
Then in that sense, you can be pulled offside. So, look, it's a law that referees, an assistant referee, should find easy to operate. But I can tell you, I can, again, sit in a room and show some of these clips, as I've done in the past, and you do not get 100% consensus.
Yeah.
And you can get some guys who will argue vociferously that goal should be allowed. Because one of the things that you want in football is you don't want a law that actually scrubs goals out, but offside does. So, toenails offside and all that goes with it, there's got to be a datum point of which it operates. I think it's been, you know, the offside law, particularly on interfering with an opponent, this deliberate play, they tried to simplify the law and they've actually further complicated it.
Yeah. Well, on to a different game. Rotherham, obviously, at this point in the game, we were 2-1 down. And to be honest, I think if you asked any Sunderland fan in the game, we probably didn't actually deserve anything out of it, performance-based. But practically the last kick of the game, there was a free kick to Sunderland. Ball goes into the box. Luke O'Neill and the Rotherham keeper, I think it's Johansson, collide. Neither get near the ball, ends up in the back of the net, but it is ruled out for a foul on the keeper. And I think this is one of the decisions so far this season that has very much been 50-50, because what I do think you see nowadays, and obviously I'll get your opinion on this as well, is goalkeepers are very protected nowadays.
Well, I don't think it's changed. I think that over the years, that accusation has always been made. I think, in a way, what we've got to understand is that the goalkeeper often comes out, arms outstretched. There's a degree of vulnerability. But, you know, I saw Pickford at the weekend come out, make a challenge, almost a two-footed challenge, scissor challenge on a forward. It was a penalty kick for me and could well have been a red card. Let's go with a penalty kick. Absolutely nothing was given and nothing was said. Yeah. And I just find that slightly amazing. I think that if we look at the amount of time wasting that goes on with goalkeepers, that's an issue. I think that where you've got to protect the goalkeeper is when someone is leading with their arm. And that's where it becomes pretty vulnerable, that the goalkeeper's going to get the benefit of the doubt. But look, what we see in the modern game is this nonsense, don't we, of holding, pulling, grappling, whatever you want, inside the penalty area. We see the referee going in and trying to make a point, look, I'm watching, comes out and does nothing. And I think that all grappling, holding and offences inside the penalty area are because, I think, of weak refereeing. I know it's not referees that commit offences, but if you allow players to get away with things, then you've got a problem.
Yeah.
And I think there is a problem in that area. But I think always the goalkeepers, to some degree, the referee's got his sight line and he's watching what the forward is doing.
Yeah.
But on that particular point, just there are often offences take place before the ball arrives.
Yeah.
And sometimes the fans don't pick up on that.
Yeah. But on that specific Rotherham goal, or disallowed goal as it is, it actually leads back to what we said a little bit earlier as well on the whole head injury thing. Because I think the keeper goes down holding his head, gets up, makes the second save, realises the ball's gone behind him, goes down, holds his head, gets the free kick. When you've watched it back, do you think that is the right decision for a free kick for Rotherham?
I think it was a harsh decision. I think the ref, in truth, I think the referee's gone safety first. You know, he doesn't want a goal scored that looks iffy or whatever.
Yeah.
And I think he's just gone safety first. And you know, when a referee does that, invariably it bites you as a referee. Yeah. You know, you've made the wrong guess. Gets back to that initial point, doesn't it? How interestingly players now, whether they're outfield players or goalkeepers, are making this excuse about head injuries that I think is in fact creating a problem for refereeing. And it is, you know, it is those sort of areas where you've got a responsibility. But I would like players to show, you know, you can be competitive, but you can also respect your opponent.
Yeah.
And I just think that there just needs to be a little bit more honesty in the game.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm talking about very few players, but you talked about Messi early, going down early. We know it. Ronaldo's the same. You know, I think what was interesting was the German forward, and names just goes at the moment, Blondhead, when he joined Tottenham Hotspur, he came with a reputation of diving, but when he came into the English game, he cut it down. And I think there's some influences that the English game can bring on players that are actually for the better rather than the worse.
Yeah. Well, on the second to last decision, this was obviously a red card in the Hull City game, and it was a tackle that actually ended Embleton's season. From the first angle that you see, I think it does look like a red card offence. Although at the time, at the second it happened, I actually thought we'd got the free kick. Second angle probably shows a little less contact than you'd expect than if you'd watched it from the first. Like you've said to me before, I think both players go into it kind of off the feet. Embleton goes in with his leg raised.
Yeah.
And I'd say from the first angle, I think it looks like he has got his studs in his chest. Second angle shows he's slightly missed it. Do you think a red card is the right one for this one?
I'm going to put myself in the line of the referee. And I think he's going to give a red card, and I can understand why.
Yeah.
But I think it also shows why you need a great deal of experience, because what you do is you give yourself some thinking time, and he didn't. Now, sometimes the outcome can give you a good picture of what is actually taking place. And I feel sometimes referees are jumping in a bit like we saw with Stuart Atwell this weekend. He gets a yellow card out. You know, I think in this particular game, Tottenham-Chelsea, there's two players clash. He's come out. There's a push in the face. He's got his yellow card out. He goes to see the linesman, the assistant referee. He comes back, gives a red, and then goes back and has another look.
Yeah.
And rescinds it. Correct decision. I think this is one where VAR would have been enormously helpful, because as you rightly say, it is so dependent on the angle that you see.
Yeah.
But it also says to players, you cannot make a challenge for the ball with both feet off the ground.
Chest height.
Because you're out of control. But in this occasion, both players were off the ground. And therefore, I think that personally, my reaction would have been yellow card. Because maybe it's me. I didn't like dismissing players as a referee, because I saw that as a weakness. But I was still regarded as a pretty strong referee. But I think as a fair referee, you don't make guesses. And if there is an element of doubt, you go with the element of doubt.
Yeah.
And I think there was an element of doubt. And you're right to say that I'm sure with other angles, it would have been a different outcome. And I'm not, you know, the referee's only got one view and he's seen it in real time. All those sort of things. He hasn't got a second thing. This is where VAR really does come to its fore if it's used sensibly.
Yeah. On to the last game, that we're going to look at a decision from, and it was the, let's say, the Coventry game, which was at the weekend. I had the pleasure of being to that one, which is a nice 3.5 hour drive from where I am.
Yeah.
Performance wasn't the greatest again. I'm used to that from away games. I think it's now one away game in 5 years I've seen us win, which isn't the best record. But the opening goal comes from two things. Two potential fouls, which we'll get
to. Let me be very clear here. These were two. The first one was a reckless challenge.
Yeah.
Right? Very clear yellow card offence. There were no ifs about it. It was bordering red. Because this was a kick at. And he was fortunate, but he took the man. The referee, go on, explain it. I'm jumping in too quickly, but what has happened here is he fouled the guy. He's then got up and he's then committed another. So that's a yellow card, should have been.
Yeah.
The referee's in a good position. So you suddenly doubt whether in fact that I'm judging it wrong, looking at the video. Then what you see is that same player blocks an opponent off, completely blocks him. He's used a tanker method, as I call it, and that is let's just stop him and act like a skittle, a ball hitting skittles. Referee does nothing again, and they go on and score. This is, for a referee who's very experienced, Dean Whitestone, who I thought was having quite a good game, because I've looked at most of the game, and I'm thinking, yeah, he's allowing the game to breathe, he's allowing it to flow. The one thing is that, excuse me, you still got to control the match.
Yeah.
Now, when I'm coaching referees, I talk about safety refereeing. And I explain to them and show them some film clips where two challenges like that, not ignored by the referee, has resulted in mass confrontation. And I go back to my own experience, because I allowed a couple of fouls to go unpunished and in a game, which then resulted in a mass confrontation of 21 players. And this was Manchester United versus Arsenal, the Battle of Old Trafford, as it was known.
Yeah.
I'm then, it calms down within 16 seconds. But in reality, I'm then saying, well, which one of the 21 do I send off? Because I could have sent everybody off. Outcome was I issued an absolutely second-by-second blow as far as the report is concerned to the FA. And eventually those two teams were deducted points. The point I'm trying to make here is that you can be too hung up in a game, wanting to keep it flowing. You're enthusiastic to keep it going, and sometimes it blows up on you. This one, this goal shouldn't have been allowed. You know, no VAR. I think, you know, they've got communication kits. And I think if I was the assistant referee, I think I'd be saying to the referee, go back and give a free kick. But of course, he's allowed it because it's near the halfway line, these two challenges. And play has continued for a few seconds. He's in a position where I hope that he's reviewed that. I hope that he probably won't repeat that error in the future. But for me, that was a goal that should have been ruled out by the very nature of the free kick should have been awarded.
Yeah. And there was obviously Coventry fans after the game that I was talking to. And some, again, with fouls, some people will say it's a foul, some people will say it won't. Yeah, it isn't. But one thing that's actually really hard to see in the clip that I sent you, and pretty much in any clip that I could find, because I couldn't find the one that I originally saw. But after that second foul, the same player handles the ball with his right hand onto his left hand and carries on the player. So there's them two fouls, which you say are fouls, and then there's two handballs by the same player as well, which the referee, in fair to him, probably wouldn't have the best view of that. But from where it happens, the linesman would have a clear view of it. And the Coventry fan that I was talking to made the argument that it wasn't a deliberate handball. It hit his hand on his other hand. But as far as I'm aware, and I'm sure you'll correct me if I'm wrong here, in an attacking phase of play, if the ball hits your hand, it's handball. It's another career, isn't it?
No, well, no. I think that what you have to do when you're judging handball, you have to determine whether the action has been deliberate. That's the first thing. This is in open play, as this was. And you're looking for the movement of the hand to the ball. And therefore, you're actually saying to yourself, that scenario to begin with. The further complication then comes in relation to not just whether it's deliberate, because if you accidentally handle the ball and it goes directly into goal, then that goal is ruled out. And that's where I think it confuses. So the referee's got to determine, did he deliberately, was the movement towards the hand, hand to ball? Was the body shape, if the ball's invariably coming towards him, or if as he held his hand out from his body so that the ball strikes the hand, all these sort of scenarios have to come into play. The handball law, from my era of refereeing to now, has been overcomplicated dramatically to confuse and to leave these grey areas. But in reality, it's not the shirt sleeve, that doesn't count. It's the underside of the armpit, right, to the including the hand, right? So underside of the armpit to hand is an action of where the law talks about hand movement towards the ball, body shape bigger. And the shoulder, which in my day would have been penalised, is no longer penalised. So you can effectively shoulder the ball, and that is not an offence now, whereas in my era it was. And of course, accidental handball into goal would have been allowed, but now that's not allowed.
Yeah.
So it's complication on handball.
Well, that is all the decisions that we were going to look at, and that is everything covered, I think, in terms of what we were going to cover today. So last but not least, I just want to appreciate the time that you've given us today, Keith.
Pleasure.
We will be back with another podcast on Sunday, of course. We play Stoke City on Saturday afternoon. Just quickly, score prediction, Sunderland Stoke.
I think that'll be a difficult game.
So the return of Alex Neil as well, which adds an extra bite.
I generally think that going to the Stadium of Light should be an area where Sunderland have the advantage. And I think given how the game is going at the moment, they should get a home win.
Hopefully so. We need a win. But like I said, that is on Saturday, 3 p.m. kickoff. So we will be back on Sunday to talk everything about that game. But until then, we will see you later.
That's all, folks.